From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll hear from the director of Advancing a Healthier Wisconsin Endowment and his work helping end the transgender military ban. Then UW-Milwaukee's top leader overseeing diversity and equity efforts describes her hopes for the future as she gets ready to retire.
It's the right time to go, and everything is in place to even take it to the next level and give people an opportunity to think about what's next and where they'd like to take it.
We'll learn about COVID-19 scams and how to deal with them.
What we found is that scammers really follow the news. And so whatever seems to be going on in the news, they will capitalize on.
Plus, composer Paul Williams talks about his work on Fortunate Sons, premiering this weekend at Skylight Music Theater. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll learn about diversity and equity efforts at UW-Milwaukee as one of their top administrators prepares to retire. We'll tell you about some common COVID-19 scams to look out for, and composer Paul Williams talks about his work on Fortunate Sons, a musical about the Vietnam draft. We'll start with this. In 2015, transgender people were banned from serving in the military. At the time, Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld was serving as a U.S. Navy Reserve medic in Afghanistan. He raised a question about the ban to then-Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter at a military town hall. It was the first step that led to the ban's repeal in 2016. But just a year later, the Trump administration reinstated the ban. The ban was once again repealed last month after President Biden took office. Ehrenfeld is now the director of the Advancing a Healthier Wisconsin Endowment at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about his work to improve healthcare in Wisconsin and begins by explaining why he decided to follow in his family's tradition of service.
There's sort of this long history. I'd always been kind of drawn to service in a variety of contexts, hence going into medicine. And I always thought to myself, why shouldn't our soldiers and service members and sailors have somebody like me who's well-trained, taking care of them on the front lines? And so at the end of residency, when I finished at Harvard, I decided to go ahead and become a reservist. And so that brought me into the Navy.
And you also entered the military while Don't Ask, Don't Tell was in place. Is that correct?
That's correct. I got my commission in 2008, and it was in effect, and it wasn't until 3 years later, 2011, that President Obama repealed the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy.
So 3 years, that's a long time, you know, and I know other service members have worked with it even longer, but how did that impact you and inform the advocacy work you do today?
You know, I had a lot of awkward moments. You know, I can remember being hit on by women. And that was difficult to manage because I couldn't sort of tell my side of things or be my authentic self. I had one person in my unit who kept sending me Facebook friend requests. And it became very awkward because I couldn't accept that because it would give him visibility into my identity as a gay man. And so, you know, as a medical officer, I found myself in a position to fare reasonably well in serving under that policy. I came, I did my work, certainly a lot easier than I think other folks had it, but definitely it had its moments.
Was there a point where it started to become clear that your professional identity would intersect with other parts of your life so much, especially being a gay man serving in the military?
Yeah, no, I've always felt a need to stand up for those who can't and various aspects of my life and community. That started, you know, in medical school when I worked on trying to improve, you know, LGBT health education, continued through residency and beyond, even to this day in my work here in Wisconsin.
So before we get to your work here in Wisconsin, I kind of want to go back to one of the many things that sparks and shapes your career today. But going back to 2015 with you in a room at Kandahar Airfield in Afghanistan, when you were able to question then Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter about his stance on transgender individuals serving in the military, which at the time they weren't allowed, at least openly, to serve. So what prompted you to ask that question during a period where, you know, it was still a big risk to basically take the mic on an open floor and voice this question, but also puts yourself in a vulnerable place, you know?
Yeah, so I was deployed in Afghanistan serving as a medical officer. And before that opportunity arose in February of 2015, I got a call from an Air Force colonel who said, I've got a patient I'm going to send to you. I said, no problem, doc, what's going on? And you know, we sort of discussed it. And he said, by the way, this patient is transgender. And I said, that's odd because there's a ban. And the last place you'd expect to find a trans airman was deployed in Afghanistan. And yet an hour or so later, I met this individual, took care of them, became friendly with them, and ended up serving the remainder of my deployment alongside of them. And so a few months later, when the newly minted Secretary of Defense in his first week on the job dropped by for a kind of troop town hall, I was seated next to this person who literally had no voice, had no opportunity to stand up and ask about, you know, serving as a trans person, because it would have outed him and been the end of his deployment and probably career. And so I remember turning to Logan and saying, you know, if you could get up and ask the secretary any question, what would it be? And so that's what led to my standing up in front of the press pool and asking the new Secretary of Defense about open transgender service.
As I mentioned before, your question kind of sparked some action on the military side. And a year after you asked Secretary Carter that question, the ban was repealed. So how does it feel to be that push that truly got the conversations going in the rooms where policy happens in order to make change?
You know, I cried. I remember June 30th, 2016, when the secretary ended the ban. I was in the Pentagon that day as that announcement was made. And a few hours later, the then Secretary of the Army, Eric Fanning, promoted me to the rank of commander from lieutenant commander in his office. And it was an extraordinarily emotionally filled day to watch this really unfortunate policy finally come to an end that had really destroyed many careers and put the brakes on so many things that I knew were possible for our service members across the country.
Now, to go from such a momentous and joyous occasion to, in relatively recent history, that ban was repealed, and then we had to go back, take five steps back, and the Trump administration reinstated a trans military ban. So what harm has been caused by that action, and do you think simply having a new administration now will help quickly restore transgender military service?
You know, it's interesting. When the ban was repealed, I remember having lots of conversations with my shipmates about what does this mean? Because a lot of folks just don't really understand. They may not know transgender people. They may not have transgender friends or family members. And so I think when that policy was changed, it generated a lot of questions amongst the force. And I remember distinctly being with my unit, and a sailor who I didn't know very well came up to me and he said, you know what, I've got a transgender brother. And so I know we're going to be talking about this with the rest of the unit and other folks. And, you know, I'd like to participate in those conversations because I think I have something to add. And here's somebody who I had kind of worked alongside a little bit, you know, for some period of time and had never known that about them. They certainly didn't feel comfortable disclosing that. And yet, you know, this is a person who was looked to as a stellar leader, you know, fellow shipmate. And finally felt empowered to bring that forward. And I think a lot of folks had moments like that when that policy changed and the force started to work on implementation of the end of the ban.
Do you think that having it repealed so recently and then reinstated is the culture of the military just waiting for a change in policy, or do you see just even more lasting damage?
You know, I think the fact that you had almost a year after the change, a reinstatement of the ban, and now 4 years roughly later, another re-repeal is definitely damaging. I think that, you know, it's hard to turn the largest employer in the world and that's the US military, 3.2 million people, I think, on a dime. You know, I'm optimistic that this will be an important and lasting step forward. If you had looked at, you know, the activity since the ban was reinstated, there were a number of legal actions that had been filed to try to reverse it. I know Congress obviously had looked at it. I had the opportunity to testify in Congress in 2019 on the issue. And I think that there was a pretty clear consensus amongst the professional military leadership that the reinstatement of the ban was a political decision, not one that was based in science or fact. President Biden on January 25th issued an executive order that has lifted the ban, and couldn't be happier that the president has done that. It's an important step forward for so many reasons. One, you know, there's roughly 15,000 transgender service members actively serving. So it has an immediate impact on their ability to contribute to the mission completely, authentically, without having to dance around these issues. But also, it's an important step forward for our country in terms of equality. Again, you've got the world's largest employer making a really important policy change that is a move towards inclusivity. And that has important ramifications when you think about how it becomes a model for the rest of the country, as well as the world.
Currently, you are the new director of the Advancing a Healthier Wisconsin Endowment and a senior associate dean at the Medical College of Wisconsin School of Medicine. So what drew you to bring your experience, your knowledge to Wisconsin?
Well, I was recruited into this role, and for me, it's a dream job to be at the helm of a statewide philanthropy that lives in an academic medical center that can leverage its resources to improve health at scale. And that's what we do. And I've got an incredible team of folks who are dedicated and committed to that mission, wonderful partnerships around the state. And we have more than 1,000 community partners in almost every county that work with us, that are funded by us, that we help to grow their capacity to do good work, and to help drive that forward, to elevate the impact of the work, was something that I just couldn't say no to.
Your work today involves making sure care is equitable. And in regard to improving care for LGBTQ people, what do you believe are the main areas that are either current protocols, lack of research, or best practices that are lacking on a national front? What are the main obstacles to care?
Yeah, so the there are a couple of gaps. One is the access and coverage landscape that has changed markedly. Not every Medicare contractor or Medicaid agency has provided complete coverage. Most of the third-party payers have, but there are still gaps. That has changed markedly in the last 5 years. So that's helpful when the third-party payers are starting to provide coverage for services. There still is a huge training gap. And, you know, the vast majority of the healthcare workforce went through medical school, nursing school, whatever school they went through, without really getting trained in issues around LGBT or T care. That's starting to change. Most health profession schools have incorporated training into their curricula. That's starting to happen at the graduate medical education level, the residencies and fellowships that, that physicians go through after the fact. But there's still a gap. And that's why places like MCW have launched initiatives to bring comprehensive multidisciplinary care forward out into the community. But there are still huge, huge needs.
Now, when it comes to Wisconsin specifically, in your work here and what drew you here, where do you think Wisconsin stands when it comes to its ranking in offering equitable care?
Well, from a policy standpoint, the healthcare laws and policies are actually in a pretty good standpoint. The state Medicaid policy covers transition services for transgender individuals. The state health plan covers transgender inclusive care. So those are all great things. That being said, you know, there are still real gaps in terms of where people can go to get high quality comprehensive care. And, you know, here in Milwaukee at MCW, we have patients who drive quite a distance to come and see us. Sometimes now it's a little bit easier with the virtual visits that we're able to provide through telemedicine. But, you know, there are roughly 20,000 transgender individuals living in Wisconsin, and there's only one comprehensive multidisciplinary clinic anywhere in the state.
Well, Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld, I want to thank you so much for sharing your time and your work and your valuable perspective.
Thanks for having me. This has been fun.
Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld is the director of the Advancing a Healthier Wisconsin Endowment and senior associate dean at the Medical College of Wisconsin School of Medicine. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you could find their full conversation at WUWM.com. Coming up in about 20 minutes, we'll be joined by composer Paul Williams. Although you may know him for his pop hits like Rainbow Connection and Rainy Days and Mondays, he'll be talking about his latest project, Fortunate Sons, a musical about the Vietnam draft and life in 1960s America. But first, UW-Milwaukee's top leader overseeing diversity and equity efforts is retiring after 20 years at the school. We'll hear more from Joan Price about the work she's done to create a more supportive campus for students of color. That's next on Lake Effect, here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. One of UW-Milwaukee's top administrators is retiring after 20 years at the university. Joan Price is Vice Chancellor of Global Inclusion and Engagement. She's overseen diversity and equity efforts at the university for two decades. Prince is also a four-time graduate of UWM, earning two bachelor's degrees, a master's, and a doctorate. WUWM education reporter Emily Files talked to Prince about her work fostering diversity and inclusion at UWM and what she thinks still needs to be done to make the university a better place for underrepresented students.
Being in the position allowed me to do fabulous things. I was able to connect on a global level, really looking around equity and opportunities for students mostly, but also for our faculty and staff. So I had the pleasure globally of crafting and implementing the first diversity and study abroad program. I took a look at our study abroad opportunities and said, you know what? We don't have enough diversity in who's signing up, who even understands the benefit of studying abroad. And went to our provost, and that partnership with academic affairs and with our faculty really helped this program to blossom. So to see a person who is historically underserved, who many of whom had never left Milwaukee or Wisconsin, we were able to offer scholarships and provide opportunities for them. One of the things I'm particularly proud of is as I leave, as I walk out the door, we now have a required anti-bias, anti-racist program that all faculty and staff have to engage in so that our campus culture is welcoming and equitable for all of our students. So I'm particularly proud, if you can tell in my voice, I'm particularly proud that will be in place.
Another recent announcement from UWM was that the university joined the Moonshot for Equity initiative with some other regional universities to eliminate graduation gaps, racial graduation gaps in 10 years. So what has your involvement in that effort been? And as you're departing UWM, what do you think needs to happen in order to accomplish that?
Well, as you know, the Moonshot for Equity has been announced in the last couple of months, and I am exiting. So I have not had the opportunity for any deep work or impact at all inside of that initiative that will pass to the next individual. But I will say this about the concept behind Moonshot and the concept, which I think needs to really be discussed overall, and that is, yes, we must eliminate graduation gaps in all of our students, particularly looking at the Black-white graduation gap, but it doesn't matter. All of our students, if you work on looking at climate, looking at indicators, keeping track of those metrics where you may need to intervene and assist a student, understanding that the traditional 18-year-old student does not truly exist as much anymore. So what have we done to change our programming, our support systems, our student success focus around making sure that we are able to support all students? And I think that's really what Moonshot is trying to do. I get asked this question a lot, as you can probably imagine, around achievement and eliminating achievement gaps, or what can we do to be more equitable. And I always like to say that you work where you are, you improve where you are. So our scope is the education side and the higher education side. There are opportunities to work with the K-12 side, which also happens. At the end of the day, you have to work with the employer side. It doesn't help if you eliminate the achievement gap, and yet there's no equity in who gets hired, who gets promoted, who gets advanced, because that's all tied into your economic prowess and your quality of life. And it's going to take that entire pipeline to really advance what will be an equitable opportunity for any child born, and I'll stick to Wisconsin for now, but any child born in the state of Wisconsin who enters our doors at the University of Wisconsin system, particularly at UW-Milwaukee.
What work do you think remains to be done at UWM to improve opportunities for underrepresented students, students of color, first-generation students?
Sure.
What would you like to see happen?
Well, I think we're heading there. We're heading in that direction. And I think, number one, you have to have the students. So I think recruiting those students to campus has to continue and increase. And again, trying to do that work inside of a pandemic has been challenging, but the work has continued and they've tried very hard to work on those numbers. So I would say, number one, you have to have the students as part of the institution in order to make that happen. So the recruitment, get them acquainted with the campus, with the climate, with the offerings, I think is essential. That needs to be done. Number two, I think, is actually the recruitment of a diverse faculty. And when I say diverse, it isn't just racially diverse or ethnically diverse. We need faculty that we can put in front of a student that shows the student the possibilities of the world. And so we have to diversify the faculty. We have an initiative that you'll hear more about over the coming months and years to do that and to work on just that. So I think that's the second piece of this. And then finally, I would say the third piece is looking for opportunities for the students that come on the campus, to learn about each other, to connect with each other's culture, religion. You know, we all don't think alike and we all don't need to think alike, but what we have to do is respect each other's opinions and thoughts. So how do we promote that really crucial conversation and dialogue among students and between groups of students to help them understand and to be the best they can be when they leave our institution? They have to be the whole person, right? Our job is to make them the whole person. And I think doing that, promoting cultural connections across race, across thinking, across all of it, is really where probably that third component of the triangle.
What legacy do you feel like you're leaving at UWM?
Oh, that's a loaded question. What legacy? Well, you know, at the end of the day, I would say the legacy that I hope I'm leaving might be two words. She cared. She cared. I tried to do that. I tried to care about each and every individual that crossed my path, each and every issue that crossed my path, and tried to have a positive impact on change. So I think the legacy that I'll leave behind would be opening up pathways for individuals, passing the baton well, Always like to see a lady knows how to exit. So passing the baton well and being able to walk away and look back and say, doggone it, everything is really good. It's the right time to go and everything is in place to even take it to the next level and enhance and give people an opportunity to think about what's next and where they'd like to take it. So I hope that's my legacy, that I was able to bring a smile to faces and opportunities for all of the people that crossed my path, students, faculty, and staff.
Joan Prince is Vice Chancellor of Global Inclusion and Engagement at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke with WUWM education reporter Emily Files ahead of her retirement from the university on March 1st. Scams. They're the reason you fear picking up calls from mystery numbers, and they're getting more sophisticated. As the COVID-19 pandemic continues, many scammers have seized on the crisis as a way to get your personal information and, ultimately, your money. So how do you spot them, and what can you do to avoid them in the first place? The Better Business Bureau has some tips. Lisa Schiller is the Director of Investigations and Media Relations for the Bureau here in Wisconsin, and she joins me now to talk about COVID-19 scams. Lisa, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Give me a rundown of how these scams tend to work. Are people being called, emailed?
Well, there are so many scams, as we've learned, related to the COVID-19 pandemic. So we really try to stay on top of them, get the warnings out fast, get press releases out public. It's been hard. It's been hard to follow them all. But I would say that the vast majority probably deal with websites that have been created by scammers, although the consumer off the street doesn't know that right away. Oftentimes the websites look legitimate. You know, there might even be logos and a lot of color, and especially offers for really inexpensive prices on items, especially PPE. We saw a lot of that in the beginning of the year 2020. And then through the year, we saw a lot of websites pop up offering a lot of masks and that type of thing. And what would arrive, if anything arrived at all, was usually substandard.
What are some examples of the kinds of scams that people have been dealing with?
Well, in regard to COVID-19, I mean, there's been really a variety. What we found is that scammers really follow the news. And so whatever seems to be going on in the news, they will capitalize on. For example, right now there's a big surge in Amazon imposters. So we're seeing a lot of reports from consumers that they're receiving calls and emails claiming to be from Amazon when those are simply imposters. But Amazon has seen a huge surge in business because of COVID-19. And so scammers are going to try to cash in on that. They know that the Amazon name is well known, it's trusted, people use it. And so they're going to try to capitalize on that. Also, what we're starting to see now, and we'll probably continue to see, is that a lot of people aren't aware that although the vaccine is underway, I don't think a lot of people are aware that consumers actually receive a vaccine record card. So it's a COVID-19 vaccination record card. It's just a small white card. It has a space for your name and your date of birth. And also it asks for a patient number. So, you know, I can see some consumers maybe putting a Medicare number or an insurance number on there. And some people have shared it on social media. So, you know, that's information we don't want to get in the hands of scammers. So there's two examples of some current COVID-19 scams.
Well, and that gets to one of the big questions here. There's so many different kinds of scams that are targeting people, and they're after a number of different things. As far as these COVID-19 scams have gone so far, it seems like they're mostly looking for money. But what all are they trying to get from people?
Scammers always want your personal information, your name, date of birth, any other information they can get. That's very important to them because they can do a lot of damage with that information. For example, the vaccine card, it has a space for your name and your date of birth. And then let's say somebody doesn't put a number at all, but it has your name and date of birth. That's all scammers need. You wouldn't believe what they can do with just that little bit of information. You know, so scammers are always out for your personal information. They'll like to steal your identity if they can. But I think most importantly, they're after your money. So anything they can do to take advantage of your money and gain that, they're going to do it.
When we're thinking about the different ways that scammers approach people, we're looking at, it seems like, phone calls, text messages, emails, different kinds of digital messages. What are some of the hallmarks that this is a scam, that this is something you shouldn't trust?
Sure. Well, in phone scams, the caller ID may or may not say, you know, where they're calling from. So if they claim to be calling from Amazon, they can easily spoof the phone numbers, and your caller ID can show that it's Amazon, but it's really not. In fact, we know that back in October, we started to receive reports about Amazon imposters, and they were actually spoofing the Better Business Bureau's phone number. So, you know, that's a common trait of scammers, is to manipulate phone numbers, and the caller ID, unfortunately for consumers, cannot be trusted. So we always say, well, based on that, don't answer the phone if you don't know who's calling and you're not expecting a phone call, because if it's somebody important and it's legitimate, they will leave a message and then you can call back. Because otherwise, you know, if you answer the phone and it's a robocall, a scammer that's there to talk to you, and often these robocalls will ask you to press a button and then put you in touch with a live scammer. So, you know, if you answer the phone, it just simply tells the scammer that they've got a live one on the other end, even if you hang up right away. So, you know, don't answer the phone if you don't know who it is. And then hallmarks of a fake email or a phishing email would be incorrect grammar, English that just doesn't sound correct. It's not the way we would talk. A lot of capital letters in the middle of sentences, missing punctuation, you know, again, improper punctuation, and that type of thing. A lot of times, like in the fake websites that we see, there is either no information as far as being able to contact the company, so no contact information, or the contact information is not accurate or legitimate.
Are there any proactive ways that you can protect yourself from these scams? Something like a do not call list, or, you know, setting up something with your email that maybe filters out these kinds of things?
Absolutely. We do always tell people that they should register with the do not call list. Now, it won't prevent all of the scam calls from coming in, but it may prevent some. And I always say, you know, once you're registered with the do not call list, which you can do through the Federal Trade Commission at FTC.gov, once you're registered, then it's really easy and very quick to be able to report any scam calls that you receive, any robocalls you receive. And I personally, I report every single one that I get. I take a minute to do that, even if, you know, I play catch up at the end of the week, because I know that information helps the Federal Trade Commission. You might not hear back from them. You might not ever hear back from them. At least the information has been reported. And believe it or not, there are people on the other end that really care about that, that are looking into these phone numbers and actually researching and investigating. Other than the do not call list, you know, our telephone companies now have become more sophisticated. And in fact, today I got a phone call and it said scam call. So the phone companies are starting to capture more and more of these phone numbers. Of course, it's really hard to keep up because, you know, scammers are constantly coming up with new numbers. As soon as, you know, certain numbers that they're using are used so often, they drop those, they move on to new ones. They always try to stay a step ahead of us. You know, talk to your telephone provider and find out if they have any blocking techniques. Some are free, some you may have to pay a small fee for, but look into that and ask them what they're doing about blocking scam calls just in general, because, you know, more and more companies are starting to do that. We want to be able to get this information out to others. If I don't know that you received a scam call because you didn't report it, I may never know about it. So we have a fantastic tool on our website, bdb.org. It's called Scam Tracker. And it's very easy and quick to report. You just click on report a scam and follow the prompts, answer the questions that you can. If you want to remain anonymous, that's totally fine. Otherwise, there is a space for your name and email address, which of course we won't share. But sometimes we like to contact the consumer and inform them of information related to the scam that they submitted. So we do like to get back to you and provide that information as well. But it's a really handy tool. So always take time to report. You know, we want everybody to know what's going on and how to protect themselves.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing this information.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Lisa Schiller is the Director of Investigations and Media Relations for the Better Business Bureau serving Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll be joined by the team behind the new musical Fortunate Sons, premiering at Skylight Music Theater this weekend. Composer Paul Williams explains what excited him about this show and why he wanted to be a part of it. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. 1969 was a year of immense change. The first man landed on the moon. Hippies converged on Woodstock. Civil rights leader Fred Hampton was murdered. And the first draft lottery was held for the Vietnam War. Millions of Americans watched to see if they or their loved ones would be drafted to fight in an increasingly unpopular war through a system that many viewed as unfair. As Creedence Clearwater Revival would declare that same year, "I ain't no millionaire son. I ain't no fortunate one." The new musical Fortunate Sons is a snapshot of the social change happening at that moment through the eyes of a family in Middle America. The show premieres this Friday at Milwaukee's Skylight Music Theater as a virtual staged reading. It features music by Paul Williams, a composer known for his pop hits like Rainbow Connection and an old-fashioned love song. He's also a man who lived through the draft. He joins me now along with one of the playwrights, Eric Cohen, and the director of the show, Michael Unger. Paul, Eric, Michael, thank you all so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
How did this project really get started?
The idea was brought to me by Mark Madnick, who is my co-book writer on this. And it was a subject that I was unfamiliar with, that this draft happened. I mean, I was born in the mid-60s, but wasn't really aware much of Vietnam. And it's interesting, most ideas and stories don't lend themselves to musicals because people breaking out in song is a very specific kind of art form. But this subject really seemed to be perfect for the stage and for a musical. And so it seemed like a good idea, and we started developing it from there.
Paul, you were a part of the draft, much as any man was at that time. What was that experience like for you?
Terrifying. I opposed the war. I didn't, you know, I did not believe that we had any business in Vietnam. As the years have passed, I've come to have a great deal of even more respect than I did at the time for the people that did serve. Incidentally, one of the things that I'm most excited about what we've created here, with the brilliance of Eric and Mark's script, is that it really honors both sides of this argument, the people that went, the people that didn't go, because it would have been morally just unacceptable for them. There was a morality that was a part of my decision, but there was also a fear-based dedication to not going. As a matter of fact, I got my weight under 100 pounds when I found out I was tall enough to go off and serve. So when I read the script, you know, I felt the pressure of that bizarre lottery. You know, what happens if they call, you know, your birth date? I knew people that served, you know, and some that came back and some that didn't. And it's a remarkable place in our history. And one of the things that impressed me is that some of the difficulties, some of the obstacles to having a full and fair life in 1969 are speed bumps in everyday life in 2021. So I thought it was a perfect story, a chance to look back with a dash of sentimentality, but with the stark reality that the problems these families are facing are not unlike what families all across America are facing right now.
It is such an interesting time to be revisiting this moment in our history. My father, actually, his number was called, but luckily or unluckily, he had recently dislocated his shoulder, and so he was not eventually drafted. But he would talk about that time of his life in a very conflicted way, and it seems like this show speaks to that experience. How do you dive into a topic like this that is so full of emotion on both sides, so full of these deep-rooted beliefs?
Yeah, for us, you know, we started from, I think, the most logical place, which was who would be most affected by the draft, and that was draft age men. So in this case, it was everybody who was born between 1944 and 1950. You know, it seemed logical to get a group of them together on this night to watch their fate on television, which in and of itself is strange and something that we kept thinking about. And I've said that it's, you know, it was like the first worst reality show. I mean, if you take it all the way up to modern times, we have these sort of competition shows all the time now. It's commonplace, everything from The Bachelor to, you know, American Idol. So there was that undercurrent of, wow, people really sat down to watch and find out if they were going to go to Vietnam. So, you know, we started out with these group of three or four guys who were all of draft age and all fully eligible. So 1A. And then we just sort of built a few ancillary characters around them. But as we were developing the piece, even before Paul came on board, we sort of realized that it would be most powerful as an ensemble. So to add their parents and a sister for two of these brothers, and then, you know, another friend, and just find a way to connect them all in ways that went beyond the draft. So that was sort of where we started from and just sort of started layering onto that.
I think one of the things that is so compelling about it is observing the relationships between the family members and all the other things that they're dealing with. They were massive in the time as far as, you know, something that we take for granted these days, like a mixed race relationships, to think that in 1969, that in the middle America, that could be something massive to have to deal with. The dialogue in this book, this is the most amazingly natural, all-involving dialogue I think I've ever read. And I've written a few shows or provided songs for a few shows through the years. This was unique.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's definitely a beautiful slice of life. And the first thing that I latched onto when I read it was how much we become engaged and involved in this family story and their ancillary characters that surround this living room or this basement with the TV. Paul's absolutely right in how, you know, it's a sort of a cross-section of society. It's a family like smack dab in the middle of America. But of course, you can extrapolate this out. This happened to so many, you know, millions of families. But you learn so much about this particular family as representative of perhaps most of America at the time. But you really fall in love with the characters. And it is an ensemble piece. There's no one that sticks out more than the other. So it's a really well-crafted book, I think. And Paul's music, well, it's Paul's music, so that's going to be wonderful no matter what. The lyrics are smart, and it's a really nice insight into a slice of time and a slice of life that I didn't know about. I was 9 at the time. We're very proud to bring it to Skylight. I've worked with Eric and Mark before. It's one of the things I'm most excited about doing here as the artistic director at Skylight, is to bring new works in.
Yeah. Now, Paul, you touched on this a bit, but I think people will be very familiar with your work as a composer outside of the musical theater realm a bit. The Rainbow Connection, Rainy Days and Mondays, or An Old-Fashioned Love Song. How does your work with Fortunate Sons compare and in some ways contrast with work that people may be more familiar with?
The script is the Bible. That's the Holy Grail, the characters. And one of the big major mistakes that a lot of songwriters, and probably myself at times, have made is leaping into a project like this and go, this is a great chance to write a 60s sounding hit. That's not what's called for. What's called for is to do basically two things, you know, as a composer and a lyricist. When you're interrupting somebody's beautiful play, it better be with something that either advances the story or it gives you a peek into the inner life of the characters, you know. So I've spent my entire life writing codependent anthems. I mean, I've always joked, I won't last a day without you is not a healthy thought. And you know, I'm a very romantic fellow. I'm somebody who is also intensely sentimental. I had Out in the Country with Three Dog Night, and We've Only Just Begun with The Carpenters. They were my first two hits. And at the time, Inagata DeVita was the number one album in the country. So it was so against the grain of what was commercial at the time. And what I realized is that sometimes if I write from the center of my chest, which is not witty, it's not an intellectual exercise, but it's kind of a therapy for, you know, me to sort of confess, pick me up and love me. I'm nothing without you, mommy. You know, if I put that in a song, there are people all over the world that feel like that. And it's not the hippest, you know, and it's not the most current, but it's constant. I mean that, and I imagine all the people that are lucky enough to hear you, Joy, and connect with the kind of conversation that, you know, that you encourage. There's a little drain of the loneliness and the cabin fever out of that. And I think that this particular story provides so many little opportunities to speak to what's going on inside somebody's head and heart.
It's interesting to explore this idea of connection and of ultimately vulnerability at a time when so many of us feel disconnected, so many of us feel isolated in a variety of ways. What do you hope audiences take with them from this experience, from this virtual experience, of course, but from the work that you're presenting them?
You know, for me, I think what's fascinating is for this particular work, even though it's now on 50 years ago, I think the idea of a shared experience for a family, even something that was, you know, potentially horrific or, you know, something that would rip the family apart, I think is something that most families today are not quite as familiar with. This idea that anybody ever gets together in front of a television to watch something at the same time, I don't think is that commonplace anymore. I mean, I have, you know, a 20-year-old and an 18-year-old, and they're watching shows on their phones. My wife and I are watching it somewhere else. So I can't remember the last time we were all together watching something. So I think for me, if people can take in, even in a sort of dramatic setting, what it meant to be a family together, I think that would be kind of really good, because I think it's lost in some way where we're at as a society now.
You know, I'll jump in and just say that one of the things that was unique to that time is we would sit at our, you know, in front of the television with our TV trays and watch the evening news. And we were watching, you know, fresh footage from Vietnam. It was a horror show. But with the repeated exposure to that violence and that great loss of life and limb, I think in some ways it began to dull the senses and news became entertainment. And I think that there was a certain point where the horror of what we were seeing became commonplace. One of the things that happened to us in the last 9 months, 10 months, is because of this horrific virus, we were all captive audiences that observed Floyd's murder, the knee on the neck, and we could not turn away. We could not turn away. And it, one of the most massive changes in attitudes and opinions and activism occurred because of what we saw. Wherever you land on it, or whatever, that was unacceptable. And people responded. And I think that there is a connection between what we observe as a collective unit, whether it's people around the world, the people that observed that horrible act, or a family watching, you know, young men die, you know, for a war that perhaps we should never have been in. And all that being said, I have to tell you that my respect, and this shows respect for the veterans who went because they were asked to and because they love their country. And when their country says go, that you go. I think that there's something that deserves to be seen in Fortunate Sons.
That's a tough act to follow, Paul, but I love historical fiction as a way to teach us about our world. People high up on the hill made this decision to randomly pick a bunch of birth dates out of a spinning, you know, thing full of blue capsules. And part of the impact of this piece for me is I know those people who made those decisions felt they had to for their whatever reason, democracy, of course, but do they really know on the micro level how it affected the American family? I come from a very close-knit family, three kids just like the Willett family. And to see how profoundly it impacts for the proud and the terrified, I think is a really important lesson for us all to learn. And theater as a teaching tool to me is one of the greatest gifts of the job that I do. And I think we can learn a little bit about compassion, empathy, which, you know, this world needs now always, and, you know, more than ever, because that's been tested incredibly harshly over the past many months. So it's a lesson in all those positive things without actually telling you which way to think. You know, that's one of the gifts of the understanding both sides of the equation, as Paul said.
Yeah. Well, Michael, Paul, Eric, thank you all so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Joy.
Thank you, Joy.
Paul Williams is a composer known for his songs Rainbow Connection, Rainy Days and Mondays, and an old-fashioned love song, among many others. Eric Cohen is one of the playwrights behind Fortunate Sons, and Michael Unger is the director of the play and the artistic director of Skylight Music Theater, where the musical is premiering this weekend. The staged reading will be streaming this Friday and Saturday at 8:30, and you can find more information at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear from a man who organized and walked in Milwaukee's fair housing marches of the 1960s, including the historic march across the 16th Street Viaduct. Plus, we'll learn how people with seasonal affective disorder could be hit even harder this year, and what can be done to fight off those winter blues. That's tomorrow at 10 on Lake Effect, here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.